spotlight on cutting-edge artists at this year's Big Ears Festival in Tennessee. That's 2 p.m. this Saturday on Folk Music and Beyond here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. What is a homeowners association, and why are they becoming so common? Just how did they come into being? Why have homeowners associations become a necessity of development? And how do homeowners associations or HOAs work? Why do some folks experience a symbiotic relationship with the homeowners association that helps resolve disputes, take care of maintenance and other issues, while others have a very different experience and see them as oppressive? Whether you see it as a roadmap towards governance in a friendly venture or as a survival guide, tonight we take a look at your homeowners association. As always, we want you, our most important guest, to join in the conversation. So give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Do bear in mind that our attorney guests are here to educate and inform, perhaps entertain, but they can't provide specific legal advice for specific cases that they haven't perhaps seen. But they're here to help. They're here to try to give you guidance as to how you can try to sort out these legal principles. And joining us tonight from San Mateo, Attorney Paul Lee has over 22 years of experience in construction defect litigation, condominium law, commercial business litigation, and real estate law. He's assisted homeowners associations obtain multi-billion dollar settlements, represented landlords in lease disputes, and represented contractors and subcontractors in contract disputes. Also joining us, a principal at the firm of Severide & Glahn in Sacramento, Attorney Carter Glahn has been providing advisement to homeowners associations for the better part of 20 years. Severide & Glahn has been involved in representing HOAs for more than 35 years and was directly involved in the writing of the Davis-Sterling Act, the California state law which governs the operations and regulations of homeowners associations within the state, outlining rules regarding board elections, finances, maintenance responsibilities, dispute resolution, and other key aspects of community management, essentially providing a legal framework for how HOAs should function and interact with their members. And without further ado, Carter, Paul, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Jeff. Good. Glad to be here.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what is a homeowners association and why are they becoming so common?
Well, everybody starts at once.
Why don't you go ahead?
the standard line is that the objective of the homeowners association is to protect and enhance the value of the asset. In other words, keep the property looking and value of it being at its maximum. And to look after those items that are in place to make life living there better. As to why they've become so common, I think it comes down to municipalities don't want to put in the types of amenities that people want to necessarily have around when they move into a place. Cities are not laying out money for green areas or parks, and the developer has to put those in. And as a result, the HOA needs to be there to manage that.
When we were talking before going on the air, one of the things that came up were different purposes of HOAs. In the Bay Area, we're far more likely to have HOAs that are in condos or groups of buildings, whereas in less developed parts of the state, you're more likely to have single family homes. With that understanding, how are the HOAs different for those different types of purposes?
Well, HOAs are usually governed by their CC&Rs, covenants, conditions, and restrictions. And I think in the Bay Area, because everyone is in close proximity, those CC&Rs have more rules and regulations as opposed to planned developments in larger spaces. That's just my experience. Condominium rules usually differ from planned development rules.
Yeah, I think you're right. The condo has a lot more behavioral considerations that have to be taken into account since you're living in such close proximity to each other than you do necessarily in a spread out single family dwelling type of development. And I don't know if that complicates it or makes it easier.
I think the maintenance requirements are a little bit different as well. For condominiums, the HOA is responsible for everything, but for single family homes, that maintenance is directed to the owner, not the association.
And there's other types of HOAs, are there not? Is there a difference, for example, between the HOAs for condos as opposed to perhaps HOAs in a senior community?
I don't know. From the standpoint of the law, there isn't really, other than that you may have certain restrictions written into your CC&Rs that will make it an age-restrictive development. And depending upon how they write that, if they do it properly, then that's an acceptable restriction to put in. There has been case law that has developed about such age-restricted communities. And so, but they've always been worked out within the framework of the same civil code that governs every other residential HOA in the state. Real difference comes in when you deal with, a commercial HOA versus a residential.
Now, we spoke a little before the show started, but why do some folks experience a much more symbiotic relationship with the homeowners association, while others might see them as oppressive?
I think it depends on the board of directors. Some board of directors are very, they like to micromanage people's lives. And if something they find annoying, they may contact the owner and say, hey, you're in violation of this provision of the CC&Rs or this rule. While other associations may have a very relaxed board or a relaxed property manager and where they let a lot of things slide. I really think a lot depends on the board of directors, because HOAs are typically nonprofit corporations that are governed or run by a board of directors who have to follow their governing documents, which include the bylaws, CC&Rs, and rules. So I think it really depends on how that board acts.
Yeah. So you touched on it, but I was going to say that where I want to lead into with this is talk a little bit about how do HOAs work? Runs them? Who does the decision making?
Yeah, ostensibly the HOA is actually an organism. It's an entity that's put in place to manage whatever is there that is overseen by the association. So everybody who buys into the development or the condo building actually becomes a participant in the covenant between every owner to follow the same rules, your CC&Rs. And so as those have to be somehow managed. The HOA, the association itself as a corporate entity, becomes what is there to manage that. They have to oversee working out a budget for taking care of the amenities they're supposed to take care of. And they're supposed to work out a policy for dealing with people who don't follow the rules and how you implement that. All those things are put in place by the developer usually, but they're written up to try and each CC&R is different. It's not like there's a single type across the state. They're very similar in some of their aspects, but for every community, it is tailor-made for that community by the developer. So how they work is that it's the people there living in the community who then participate in the governance of the rules under which they live.
And following up on that, they govern by, they elect a board of directors, and the board of directors are volunteers, they're not paid. And some HOAs, they hire property managers to see the day-to-day operations. Smaller associations may not have a property manager, and they just try to do things themselves.
That kind of sounds like it's a complex relationship. As somebody who lives in that vicinity, I would see the HOA both as, in some levels, a supervisor, but also they're working for me. I mean, I own a percentage of the place.
Well, and that's it. The board is supposed to be looking out for you, but also they're looking out for your neighbors. So it's a two-way street. So just because you may feel that they're being heavy-handed to you, at the same time, your neighbor may be applauding the actions they're taking because they feel that the board may be holding the line that the neighbor wants. In almost all these situations, open communication between neighbors and with your board of directors is really sort of the path to having that symbiotic, happier relationship. It's when communications break down and people don't feel they're being heard that we find most of the problems with some of these relationships with the boards and their communities.
So Jeff, you're right. A lot of members think the board works for them personally, but from the board's perspective, you don't work for one particular owner. You have to do what's in best for the whole association, not just one owner. And I think that's where sometimes conflicts arise.
Let's talk a little bit about the pros and cons of homeowners associations. What are some of the positives?
Well, if you do have a situation where you're in conflict with your neighbor, the HOA actually can act as your go-between. And so if you, I'll take a hypothetical situation, you're living in an association and your neighbor across the street decides they're going to open a shade tree mechanic operation in their front driveway, which, you know, tends to lead to partially disassembled cars or parts lying about, the front of the property may not look great, so forth. If you don't have an HOA, and sometimes this situation arises, but you have CC&Rs in place, you're responsible for enforcing those rules against your neighbor, which means you have to take up the mantle and go into court with them and still have to live next door or across the street from the person. Whereas with an HOA, you can let the HOA be the heavy in order to make sure that that situation doesn't happen. That's sort of a very specific example, but it's the same idea in that you don't have to come into direct conflict with your neighbors in order to try and keep the neighborhood looking the way you want it.
There's also an advantage regarding maintenance responsibilities. It's shared by everyone as opposed to one particular person, especially if you're in a condominium. The HOA is responsible for making the facilities look nice, maintaining the facilities. It's a shared responsibility.
And it gives you the ability to plan as well, since the HOA has to figure out a budget for reserves so that they can hopefully save for the maintenance and get it done without hitting everybody with a special assessment to suddenly deal with a problem that arises.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Why do some folks experience a symbiotic relationship with the Homeowners Association while others see them as oppressive? While they take good care of the place, does my HOA maintain such control over the activities? Is there a benefit to joining the HOA board to better understand what's going on? Tonight's guests, Paul Lee and Carter Glahn, are amongst the top few that are really practicing in this very specialized area of law, really understand the pros and cons, the ins and outs of homeowners associations. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, that's 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You can talk anything about landlord-tenant. You don't have to jump. I'm sorry, about homeowners. I'm looking at an outdated page. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. We talked about some of the pros of homeowners associations. What are some of the downsides of HOAs?
Well, in the Bay Area, a lot of people live in close proximity with one another. So some people view it as living in an apartment. So that some people don't like the closeness that deals with that comes with living at an HOA. Some people complain about the dues. Quite a bit of people complain about the dues, actually. Some people don't like the oversight that boards have.
Yeah. Didn't mean to step on you, Jeff.
I was just going to ask if some people don't want to be told they can't paint their house purple. By way of example.
Yeah. My home is my castle syndrome. And usually people can be pretty reasonable. If you read through your architectural requirements, then I'm speaking primarily, I deal with the single family dwelling idea. And if you go to your board and you talk to them about what you want to do, almost invariably you can reach some sort of agreement. But again, it's that issue of communication. A lot of the time people just barrel ahead with what they want to do and don't think they need to talk to anybody. But again, if you find that you talk to people, you can figure out a way to get past whatever is, whatever your roadblock is.
One of the questions that I've had asked, and I think Carter, you and I have a mutual friend who's raised this, is why certain types of folks gravitate towards these HOA boards and just don't want to let go. Anything that you recommend about doing about that?
Well, run for the board of directors if you see this happening. That's usually the biggest problem, is that people complain about their boards, yet they're not willing to get on the board.
And one thing you learn about getting on any board, not just an HOA board, is you learn the reason for decisions that are made, what governing regulations are in place, what the paradigm is.
Well, yeah, it's kind of that syndrome of put the worst behaving kid in class in charge and let him see what it takes to actually run the place.
Usually the owners who usually call me up are usually very disgruntled because there has been a history of deferred maintenance. All of a sudden they're getting a huge special assessment. they want to know if it's a valid special assessment. Then they want to recall the board for asking for a special assessment. And they get a lot of people riled up because of that. And a lot of times I tell them, you know, you should have run for the board.
So are most of these disputes over money?
A lot of money, and then personal behavior. Again, you know, before the show, we were talking about if you have an upstairs neighbor who's being loud and there's noise disputes, that happens as well.
So I'd like to start talking a little bit about the laws that govern boards. I mentioned earlier in the introduction of the broadcast something that I think, Carter, your firm had a hand in doing some of the writing of, but talk a little bit about the Davis-Sterling Act.
Well, obviously that's the primary law that governs HOAs and how they work in the state of California. They just recently underwent a major revamp, but yeah, it was originally put in place back in 86, after a sort of conglomeration of different laws from the Corporations Code to the Civil Code to other administrative procedures that were sort of trying to figure out how to deal with the HOAs and the governance therein. And Davis-Sterling was putting it all in one place. And it was trying to really lay down a clear game plan for what you do in all the situations, as far as how you deal with elections, how you deal with putting new policies in place, as far as enforcement of the CCNRs, how you deal with budgeting and what can be done about that. Transparency, what has to be disclosed to members and owners under the act. And then also the process through which you enforce all the rules, as far as what's required for notice on when you're going to tell somebody they have to do something. And then rules also for how the associations perform maintenance, requiring that they do reserve studies, requiring that they, you know, save for the rainy day so that they're not getting hit with that huge special assessment because they didn't plan well. It really tried to put it all in one place so that if you were looking for an answer to what you do in a given situation, then it was there.
So we were talking about Davis-Sterling. Has that been updated?
I guess it was about 8 years ago now. They had a major rewrite of it, trying to consolidate some of the pieces to it. It had been amended over the years and parts added and references into the Corporations Code and so forth. So there is, not trying to advertise for any one particular outfit or not, but there's a really good book out there as a resource for homeowners and members called the Condominium Blue Book, which has a great I see Paul has a copy of it right there in front of him. It's a great reference that I always point some of the members to when I deal with them and say, look, you know, read through some of this. But it really, despite all of its problems, and again, it's one of those situations where you don't want to let perfection be the enemy of good. While it's got its problems and things don't work, I think for the most part, it's a great move with regard to governance for HOAs here in California. But I would, if you have questions and you want to figure out what's going on, picking up a copy of the Condominium Blue Book really can help you out.
Let me turn it over to RC. Let's try RC again.
No. Hello.
Hi. Oh, good. RC, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Okay. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. I have a couple questions about special assessments.
Special assessments only occur if there's a lack of funding.
We do have RC back.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
We hear you now.
Okay. I'll make this quick. So I have a couple of questions regarding special assessments. One is, I would like to know what the highest amount your guests have ever heard of a condominium owner being assessed on a special assessment individually. And I'm looking, okay, so I'd be a first-time owner, and I'm looking at condos on Knob Hill and Russian Hill. And, you know, they're 60-plus-year-old buildings, approximately. And, you know, one of them may need an earthquake retrofit in the, you know, next year, and a roof. So what would your guests suggest that a buyer do to prepare?
Have you purchased or are you going to purchase?
Will be. Haven't yet.
No, normally when people ask me, you know, about HOAs, I ask what's in the reserve? If it's only $100, it's probably a problem. But I think you need to take into consideration the age of the building, the ask for a copy of the latest reserve study, see what the reserve study is asking for, because it'll be a projection, and then find out how much is in the bank account. That should all be disclosed to you.
Yeah, I would echo everything Paul said, that and that should be something your real estate agent should be able to get from the condo package that the association should be providing in escrow.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, what is the largest amount you've ever heard of anyone being assessed in condos on a special assessment?
I had some homeowners associations in Foster City where they had to do siding replacements. And I think they were, depending on, I as I recall, it was over 50,000 or around 50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really depends upon what it's for. I mean, I had one association where they had a $3,300 assessment per quarter for six quarters in order to cover a complete foundation repair for a common building.
Right.
But these are things you should be able to uncover before you buy, so that you'll know what's coming and can prepare accordingly. RC, stay with us. You don't have to go, but I do have to break for a station ID. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And I'm sorry, RC, you can pick up where you left off.
I was just going to say, and God only knows how costly an earthquake retrofit would be on a 20-story building.
Well, I'm sure that there's going to be engineers and multiple bids. So has the HOA done any of that yet?
They're just beginning. Mm-hmm.
In that 20-story building, is it strictly residential, all condos?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's another consideration as far as looking at the numbers that you're actually looking to disperse that cost among. Would, you know, hopefully, depending upon the size of the job, but the more people you have to disperse that cost among, the better. But it should be something you should be able to find out as far as where they are in that process.
Usually HOAs have different payment methods as well. You know, some the pay upfront option, finance option, there's different ways of paying the special assessment as well.
I see. Okay.
Well, but you do want to also ask, you also want to be sure to ask who else is participating, so you'll have an idea what your share might turn out to be when you know what their costs are.
Right, right. Okay. Thank you for all your help. I appreciate it.
RC, thank you for joining us. Let me turn it to Elena from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine. Welcome.
Hi, I'm calling about, we're under Ellis Act eviction and the landlords are converting the property to tenants in common and they're offering us a buy option. I don't know if there's such a blue book as tenants in common. What are the ups and downs of it? Is there some security or safety in the law on this? And I don't know very much about it, just a bit self-educated. I'll take the answer off the air.
So you're presently renting in what's a large rental, you know, a multi-family structure, and
yes,
your landlord wants to convert it to individual units, presumably
yes,
with some kind of a governance structure?
Has a construction underway already. Mm-hmm. And is offering offering for our unit an option to buy, but as tenants in common. And I wonder if there's stuff that protects tenants in common in the law. There's no HOA stuff, I guess. I mean, I was saying I'd take my answer off the air because I don't know a lot about it. I'm just giving you a general sketch of this is what's going on. And are there protections? What's the upside and downside of tenants in common purchasing in San Francisco?
So I really don't do that, but I think there are a lot of lawyers in San Francisco who do condo conversions, and there's a lot of tenant rights attorneys. So if they're asking you for a buy, it seems like they first need to buy you out of your tenancy, though. So
I think that the party is trying to avoid that by offering us a purchase.
You're really conflating two different issues. And one thing that isn't as clear to me is what type of a tenancy they're describing, whether you would have the exclusive right to your unit, but everybody owns it together, which would be more of a co-op, or if they're talking about a condo. My suggestion is, unless Carter wants to weigh in, my suggestion is you could find out more by either calling us up in a couple of weeks. I expect in the second week in February, we'll have the landlord-tenant attorneys back to join us. Or alternatively, you could try the lawyer referral service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. They will have attorneys that can help and that are very San Francisco-oriented. Their number is 415. Joanne, can you read that number out loud in the air?
The number is 415-989-1616.
So I'm sorry we didn't have the answers for you tonight, but I hope we gave you some ideas where to look.
Thank you.
Let me turn it over to Ron from Mariposa. Ron, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. This is Ron. Hi, Jeff.
Thank you. Welcome.
Sorry, we've sort of fallen out of touch. But I'm your aviation patent lawyer. So I have been a board member for about 18, 19 years now, and I'm currently president of the board. And I want to kind of give a perspective from the point of view of the board. You know, we would really appreciate it if the owners and the members of the board would take a lot more interest in what's going on. Usually we have to beg people to be on the board, and I would love to get off the board if I could find somebody to take my place. So there's no feeling like we have the power and we're going to assert the power. In fact, most of the time I tell my board members when we're coming up against a very difficult issue where the owner wants to do something and I really would like to give them permission and all the board members would like to, but I have to go back to my mantra and say, you know, the governing documents are what give us the power to, or the authorization, I shouldn't say power, the authorization to do these things. And we have to stay within what we're authorized to approve and what we're authorized to do. And I think a lot of the disputes between the homeowners and the board come down to the homeowners just want to do it. It makes sense to them and it makes lots of common sense. And the board members even want to help them out, but there's only so much we can do. And that's defined by the bylaws, the CC&Rs, and the Davis-Sterling. So go get on the board so you'll get an idea of what's involved in that. And read your governing documents, read your bylaws, read your CC&Rs, and join the HOA groups if you can, the ECHO, for example, and some of these other HOA groups that will help you, if you are a board member, help you to govern more intelligently and more efficiently. As far as the people, your callers who are asking about getting into it, I think one was looking into buying into a place where they've had some damage. Go to the, or you look at the minutes for the last year, and that'll give you a really good idea of what's been going on, what the problems are, what the thinking is, and what's likely to happen. So, and you're entitled to take a look at the minutes if you're a buyer. And of course, as you recommended, one of your guests recommended, read, take a look at the budget and the reserve study and see whether you have only 50% reserves or 100% or 75%. But find out what the reserves are and then talk to somebody who's a financial expert and find out if this is a reasonable reserves. And there are some rules in the Davis-Sterling Act that require boards to maintain a certain level of reserves. Not that they do, but that's what they're supposed to do. So these are some of my thoughts on this. And I don't know, do you have any questions for me as a board member and some of the things I've seen over the last almost two decades?
So you've shared some great insights, I would say.
So that's the dilemma for a board member. If they don't enforce the CC&Rs, then people are going to say, if you don't enforce it against me, you can't afford to enforce it against the next person. You've waived your right to enforce the CC&Rs. Board members get a lot of hate for that.
That's why I tell my board members, everything we have to do has to be based on what we're authorized to do. And yes, we can't show any favoritism. And that's very, very important. But if we're always basing our decisions on the CC&Rs and the bylaws, then we're not likely to show favoritism because we can, at the end of the day, well, after the end of the day, 5 years, 2 years, 1 year from now, when somebody says, oh, well, you did this this thing for the other, why won't you do it to me? Do it for me. And we can go back and say, well, here's what we did. Here's what the CC&Rs say. Here's what the bylaws said. We acted in accordance with authority. And what you're asking for is outside of the authority of what we can do. We didn't act outside the authority for this other person. So we can certainly do that. But, you know, as a board member,
disparate treatment. Disparate treatment of members is a sure way to get yourself into legal trouble within your association. I've seen that numerous times, and it's that idea that as you stated, but everybody gets treated equally. And when you start granting variances and favoritism, as you say, to one person or the other, if you read through many of the cases that have come out that have set the law outside, you know, with regard to California, a lot of it has been generated by the fact that somebody got treated differently than somebody else.
Well, yeah. And, you know, as a practical matter, you have board members who are just humans and they make mistakes, not intentionally, not because they're favoring anybody, but because they misunderstood something or misunderstood the rules because they didn't quite read the rules correctly or misread them. So that's why I recommend that board members would, if you, number one, get on the board if you own a property and you're having problems with the board, get on the board. And a lot of boards would love to have you take an active interest. But if you do, and even if you don't, read the laws, read the CC&Rs, and figure out for yourself what's going on, especially the CC&Rs and bylaws that apply to you. Make a notebook, mark them up, study them, and so that you understand exactly what the board is able to do, what information they need from you in order to do it. And that's another place where people often think they've been treated disparately. One person will come in with really good information that helps us to make a decision. It's very much, very consistent with our rules and policies. And I left out the rules, by the way, but read the rules and the bylaws and CC&Rs. And we can say, oh yeah, that's a no-brainer, go ahead. It's consistent with what we want. And somebody else comes in waving their hand, say, well, I wanna do this, this, and this. We say, well, we really have to have some documents showing exactly what you want so that we have authorization based on your documents. So we can show people later that we did it right. And they say, well, you did it for these others. Well, why won't you do it for me? Well, because they came in with documents and they showed us exactly what we needed in order to do this according to the governing documents. So read them, understand them, work with the board. The board, in our case, I can't speak for every board, but we're not out there to give you a hard time. And there are really times where I really, really want to approve something for a board member, for not a board member, but for an owner. And I just can't. I can see that what they're asking for makes sense. It's going to improve the building. It's going to make life better for everybody. But I can't approve it because it's not, I don't have authority to do so.
So the whole community's moved on. How hard is it to organize people and to modify some of these rules, to change the rules to keep up with the times?
It's certainly doable. There are a couple of ways to go about that. One, you can do a complete revision of your bylaws and your CC&Rs, in which case you should probably engage the services of an attorney. I, as an attorney, would not handle or tackle that because that's not my specialty. But I certainly can work with the attorney that puts those together and come up with a new set of rules. The problem with that, of course, is that you have to get 75% in our case, not every HOA, but in our case, we have to get 75% of the owners to approve them. And getting 75% of the owners to do anything, agree on what day to meet to talk about it is almost impossible. There are certainly rules that the boards can use to update or interpret the CC&Rs and the bylaws. And that's a little bit easier. We can make amendments to the bylaws, but again, those amendments require a meeting of all the members, and that is very difficult to do for a lot of boards.
Well, that's something that's come down the pike recently under AB 2460, dealing with that issue of problems in reaching the quorum that allows the board or the association to adjourn that meeting if they can't get their quorum, come back, give notice 20 days later, and then the quorum requirements drop to 20% of the voting power. Either present by proxy or through submitted vote, et cetera, for certain items. But again, you bring up an issue of the problem of apathy in that getting people to participate when things don't seem to be troubling them is difficult. I had one manager from an association who did a great job. This was up in the northern parts of the Central Valley here. I can't remember which town exactly, but it was up near Yuba City. But they would, for their annual meeting, it was a community-wide picnic. And so everybody would come out, they'd have a great time, Everybody would be, and they hyped it up beforehand. And so there was just tremendous community participation in this. And part of the whole proceedings for the day was this idea that we're going to bring up and talk about these items that we've discussed throughout the last few months, and whether or not we're going to go forward with this. And so, but it you know, it really was, I'd never seen anything like it, and still haven't seen anything since. But there was just tremendous community participation. But that really is the key. But be aware that there are rules that are coming down the pike to try and deal with this problem of apathy. And that's something that everybody should also be aware of, because that also can lend itself to a small cadre of the association kind of usurping the power of everybody. But at the same time, nothing was getting done. So it can be like, as I said, the communication is a two-way street, but be aware that there is the possibility of, if you don't get involved, they'll make the rules so that it'll get done anyway.
That was AB which? Say that again, please.
AB 2460, and it was going to make an amendment to 5115 of the Civil Code.
Okay, well, I'll keep an eye on that one. So, in any case, I've heard all these horror stories of boards doing terrible things and being the source of all evil and all of these fights. But I tell you, as a board member, I have a hard time getting people. I would love to get off the board. I would love to retire from the board. I'm tired, and I have no power trip to pursue on that board. It's just a duty and a job.
Ron, thank you for joining us, and I really wish you would come back on more often.
Well, I'm living out here 3.5 hours from where you are, but I wouldn't mind coming on by remote if you can work that out.
Absolutely.
I'm still around.
Absolutely. We'd love to have you back.
Take care.
You too. Thank you for calling in. Bye. And let me take a call from Arvis in Berkeley. Arvis, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hello. I'll turn off the speaker. Hello?
Hi. We hear you great. You're on the air.
Yes. And so what the situation I have is, it was tenants in common, and there's just four owners that got converted to condominium. And so everybody's on the board. But the person who agreed to be president hasn't paid the dues. And so I need to figure out how to hire an attorney to put a lien against her portion of the property for non-payment of dues.
Is this the person who's the president of the board who hasn't paid the dues?
Right.
She makes no difference.
She agreed to be president, but technically, you know, there's four owners. And then I'm the person who gets the checks for the money. You know, I'm the treasurer.
There's a couple ways of trying to collect the dues from the non-paying member. You could just file a civil suit for the money, or you could put a lien on the property.
That's what I want to do is put a lien on the property.
If you do that, if you want to do that, there's a whole process you have to go through. You have to send pre-lien warning letters, post-lien warning letters. Then you're going to have to file a lawsuit or if you want to go with the judicial foreclosure, or if you want to go through a non-judicial foreclosure, you don't have to file the lawsuit. So it is pretty complicated. I think Carter specializes in that type of
Yeah, but I just have to get an attorney to be hired to threaten for the lawsuit in the first place.
Yeah, you don't actually have to go through a legal proceeding on that. You can if you find management companies, there are companies out there that do this where they will put in place, they will send the proper pre-lien notices. So long as you first follow all of your internal policies for giving them a warning, the late notice, whatnot. As long as you follow your own, whatever you've set up for your procedures, you follow that.
I've already, notified the person.
No, no. Do you have a collection policy?
In arrears by about $3,000.
Yeah. Do you have a collection policy in place?
No.
Well, I can.
There's just four people, and it's supposed to be like a co-housing, and this person isn't cooperative.
Yeah, the only thing, and I would defer to Paul on this as far as he does a bit more of the real estate side, but if you all own the building as opposed to owning, yeah, it depends upon how it was set up.
We all own 25% of the property plus the buildings, and then it's the building, we're like in building A, and she's supposed to coordinate with me if the roof or building needs painting, that we're responsible to maintain our building. There's out of our, it's kind of like you own your own property, you know, and so she has to hire a painter to be able to pay for it, the painting.
So sometimes in these smaller associations, I've seen CCNRs that say if there's a dispute, you need to go to some sort of arbitration or mediation. That may be a route that you want to pursue, because right now, from what you're telling me, you don't
I tried to do it through Seeds, and she refused to go.
Okay, is that that's a community? I assume that's a community-based mediation program that you tried to work on with her.
I asked her to go to that, and she refused.
Well, it sounds like eventually you are either going to have to do a lien on the property, or since your amount is, can you go to small claims court for $3,000?
Yeah,
$3,000, absolutely. They've just upped the level, I believe, to $1,250. And that begs the question, can they also evict this recalcitrant co-owner?
I don't know, because she co-owns. And I don't know why she doesn't put her portion up for sale.
I don't think they can evict her, but they can definitely put a lien on the property. They could foreclose on the property. They could get a small claims judgment, then they can try to garnish wages. There's a lot, but that all entails probably the assistance of a lawyer. And
yeah, you can put the lien in.
I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, you can put the lien in place. That'll sit there and protect your interest definitely. While you can dual track this, because you can put the lien in place and then try other remedies with the owner. If the lien is enough to move them, then that often will result in at least something happening. But yeah, ultimately, if the lien goes unresolved, you can move to foreclose your interest in it, and then once the title reverts to the association, if no one buys it, then yeah, that person can be, you know, removed from their condo. It's an unfortunate outcome, but it is possible.
Okay, so
Arisa, you know where you might try to get
to small claims court.
You can go to small claims court. The limit is $12,500 as of the first of the year. You also might rely on the Bar Association of the Alameda County Bar Association can refer you to a local attorney that can assist you. They can't with small claims, but they can with your other remedies. Their number is 510-302-2222.
Okay. You know, thank you. And it's one of these situations where, you know, you hope for the best, and the fact that the tenants, and it's a condominium. It's,
I understand. Arvis, I have to let you go. We have one more call, and we literally have a minute left. But I hope we gave you some good direction, ideas to follow, and an opportunity to find a lawyer out of the East Bay. 302-2222. Let me take this last call from Donald in San Francisco. Donald, we have about a minute left.
Yes, HOAs have house rules. Can the house rules in any way distinguish or discriminate between owners versus renters in the property?
Well, only owners will have membership in the HOA unless an owner assigns their interest to a renter. The renter actually doesn't have standing to come in and participate as a member of the HOA.
No, but I mean, such things as could they say you can't use some of the facilities on the property. If there's a tennis court, and you could say, well, only the owners could use the tennis court or the swimming pool or the barbecue, and a tenant renter cannot do so.
It depends upon how the tenancy is set up, because if the part of the tenancy actually assigns the rights to the amenities to the tenant, then yes, the tenant can use it, and actually the owner would be precluded from using it. And I can't recall the name of the case that established that, but it was mm-hmm. with a tennis club where mm-hmm. the owner was actually precluded because they had assigned all of their rights to the amenities to their tenant. So you have to look at what the relationship is there as far as the agreement between the tenant and this owner.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Alrighty, thank you for joining us. And unfortunately, we are out of time. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where we're taking a bird's eye look at your homeowners association. Our guests tonight have been Carter Glahn of Sacramento and Paul Lee of San Mateo. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show tonight's been produced by yours truly, and please join us again next week where, as always, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesday at 6 p.m. A big thanks to tonight's guests, Carter Glahn and Paul Lee, and all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.